Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about solidarity. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. Jan, I'd like you to elaborate, if you will, because I know that you've got a lot of breakdowns of what Tom Hanser said that was wrong in the interview and how he behaved, and pointing that out. And I also wanted you to balance that out by pointing out my failures in the interview as well, because I need to basically learn something. Well, you know, so I don't do it again.
Well, a really good one that he used on you was when somebody brought up the flat earth bits, and he said it was just a shibboleth, which was an interesting comment from him. But shibboleth is a word, sound, or custom that a person unfamiliar with its significance may not pronounce or perform correctly, blah blah blah. Regarding the whole flat earth thing, what he did was in the middle of his attack on you, he switched the meaning of the word, and I'm just trying to find it here, more of my citations here. But okay, so you know what what we did is, in our book, we presented everything, what we were saying about the flat earth theory. So let me read that first, and then we can break down his argument about it. And he omitted most of what we wrote about this, and he just read one little quote out of context, okay? Ancient pagan religions in the Mediterranean area, and throughout the Middle East taught that the universe was quite tiny. These included the religions of ancient Europe, ancient Egypt, Babylon, Canaan, etc. The earth was often thought of as flat, like a dinner plate. Mountains around the edges held up a rigid metallic dome which formed the sky. The gods and angels pushed the sun and moon and planets across the dome of the sky on a daily basis. God sits in his throne in heaven, which lies above the great dome or canopy. Doors or windows of the dome could be opened, through which water, fire, and in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah, brimstone could be poured. This is the view of the universe that writers of the Bible appear to have adopted from these pagan religions, if one interprets their writing literally. The problem came after Aristotle suggested that the earth is a sphere. Many members of the clergy could not accept that as truth. There are a number of implications in the Bible that it is the sun that moves, not the earth. And also, in a couple pages later, we say our ancestors lacked the technology that we provide ourselves on today. For them, it made sense that the earth was like the center of the universe. From as high up on any mountain as one could climb, the earth appeared to be as flat as a chessboard. So, see, that's what he read and then took it all out of context. Well, if there's mountains, it's not flat. But what he's doing is he uses an equivocation on you to trick you right there, because we're talking about the flat earth theory and the biblical references, and he calls it a shibboleth, and then he switches it to, well, there's mountains, so the earth couldn't be flat. That's ridiculous. You see, they're two entirely different discussions and conversations. So what he did was he literally tracked you off onto another conversation, and right then, you just sat quiet. You actually caught it. You were just like, huh? But you sat quiet. You didn't call him out for it, but I could tell that you caught it.
Yeah. What was going through my mind was, hold on a second, flat earth means that, you know, people thought that they would sail to India and accidentally fall and off the side of it. Not that the whole thing is like a dinner plate.
Without mountains and stuff. So what he did was he tricked you right in the middle of the argument, using this as an attack against me, right? And so then he goes on, and we talked about this on Friday a little bit, but he attacks me for Godfrey Driver, et cetera, and these scholars that published their attack. I think it was in the London Times or something like that, the same week that Allegra published his book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. Now, in the back of The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, from page 207 to page 349.
While we're waiting there, because I also wanted to know precisely what should I have actually done in that instance with the flat Earth reference?
Those are two different topics. You know, we're not discussing if the ancients believed that mountains existed, or if, you know, we're talking about if they thought that they would go off the end of the Earth, right? You know, when they were out at sea or whatever. But, you know, you would just have to point it out to him that those are two entirely different subjects, and that that's not entirely honest for him to attack, you know, somebody for. But obviously his whole agenda was to get you to, you know, allow him to come on so that he could just spew his propaganda for an hour and then, you know, go away laughing, thinking that he's, you know, the great superhero scholar, you know. And as it's funny, speaking of the scholar issue, and then I'll get back to the quotes in Allegra's book, but the scholar issue is... he, you know, what he did was, he didn't, you know, when he talks about Carl Ruck and this great response that Carl supposedly sent him about his scholarship on this one image, he didn't debunk anything but one image. Apparently he believes that if there's one single error in a book, then it somehow debunks every single primary quote citation in there, even if it doesn't actually, you know, even if it's a very minor detail of the work. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But what he didn't admit was, in his first email to me, it was all name calling and attacks. And then he turns around and says, you know, see, Carl Ruck sent me this great email. What a scholar I am. And here is Jan Irvin's email. Well, I'm just looking for his email here that he sent me, the first one. So here it is. He says, looks like someone got caught red-handed making an argument from ignorance. And then he links his article. And he says, there's no place to hide anymore. You should have learned Latin like I suggested instead of, you know, and I'd never heard from this guy before, instead of your overuse of argumentum ad ignorantium, because you are about to look really foolish. See Appendix 2 and answer my questions. I will not respond otherwise. Checkmate, amateur. That was his first message to me. And then he says, you know, and then he reads to you my response.
Can I just interject here?
Hold on. But do you get that he read to you my response and Carl's response and then tried to attack me while omitting his own actions in the whole thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's basically it. I mean, if you've got a bad demeanor, right, and you say things in a really bad way, when you tell that story to other people, you omit the bad things that you said, only keep in the actual things that you wanted to say, and then try and do the exact same thing to the other person and only try and remember the bad things that they said and forget about all the good
things. That's exactly. And here's another really good one that he sent to me like a couple of months ago, or a month ago or so, maybe April, I forget. I probably have it here somewhere, but... he says, hey, Jan, so I was talking to the publisher or to the publishing house lawyers about my legal right to call you a fraud in my forthcoming book that demolishes your idiotic ideas. The lawyers said that it depends on if you knew at the time that you were full of shit or wholly ignorant of how dumb you truly are. My question, are you aware of the fact that you are a fraud, or are you just stupid? I ask because, legally, I can't call you a fraud or a charlatan in my book if you truly are ignorant of how stupid you are. If you are unaware of how subpar your quote-unquote research is, then I can call you a fraud all day and night. If you're not, I have to settle on words like historically inept and stupid. So I leave the decision to you. When my book comes out next year, do you want the chapter devoted to you to be titled, quote, Jan Irvin, charlatan, or, quote, Jan Irvin, idiot? Please let me know ASAP. Oh, and have a great day. Once my book comes out and everyone sees how dishonest or stupid, remember, it's your choice, you are. You won't have too many more good days. Sincerely, Thomas Alexander Hatzis, the man who has made a laughingstock out of you in real academic circles. And then, you know, closing with an appeal to authority there, you know, and I mean, you know, here's my response to him. Resorting to ad hominem attacks rather than dealing with each specific point in the research on its own merit by going one by one is really a sign of one's own mental bankruptcy and lack of mental cognizance and inability to deal with the facts. This is why they name call like little children on the playground. Fraud, charlatan, idiot, dishonest, stupid, full of shit, dumb. Excuse me, did I just read all of those out loud? I'm so sorry.
And you also did one earlier as well. But uh-oh, keep going.
Okay.
Normally we use word replacement therapy.
These are quotes.
Like the F word becomes frack. The S word becomes shiite.
And these are specific quotes, and I am reading something and quoting from it. So terms one uses to attack the man when one feels threatened and intellectually incapable of dealing with the facts and citations presented. Another trick of mental deficits is to not examine the entire argument as a whole, to cherry pick out a single item, or to cherry pick out an item to attack, known as a straw man argument, and take it out of context. How you want to present yourself is really up to you. Make sure that you take nothing out of context, which of course he did, and don't misquote anything, which of course he did, as this is when the person you're attacking and name calling at will get to take every penny from your work. If you want to sound like an intelligent human being, then you'd simply have to deal with each citation point by point in the work as a whole, rather than resorting to adolescent idiocy such as name calling. Singling out a single image and ignoring every other bit of research presented and then name calling is not a sound or intelligent way to approach things. But how one whose agenda driven protects his beliefs. Luckily, only your own reputation is on the line and your non-existent publishers. And then there was another thing here. Let me see if I can find that. But, you know, I actually got an email from a former friend of associate of his just, you know, right before that. Let me see if I can find that. Here we go.
Basically calling Tom a mental case of some kind, isn't it?
Right. So this is from February 14, 2013, and this is Tenostic Media. Just wanted Jan to know that an ex-tutor of my brother's is mentally unstable and bashing Jan on Facebook, complete with posting names and people he claims to have emailed him, calling him names and insulting him. Be careful, because Tom, who is Agrippa Weyer on Facebook, is disturbed and should not be worked with on any projects.
Mm. And who was that email sent by?
It was somebody that called themselves Indra and said that their brother was tutored by Tom Hatzis previously.
It's a sibling of a former student of Tom's.
Okay. Right. And so, you know, what we have here, though, and, you know, also this guy pointed out to me that Tom was supposedly challenging me to a debate that he never challenged me to. Like, supposedly he told everybody else about it, but never me. Right. You know, I just read you his first email and stuff. There's no challenge to a debate there or anything. And then I sent him
Perhaps he thought that if he made those challenges on public forums, that you would
show up and then he could go,
that you would be following his posts and things of that. Now, you got better work to do, you know.
Sure.
If you want to challenge me to something, just challenge me, bro, because you don't need to challenge anybody else, because nobody else is going to be at the debate, are they?
So, yeah, exactly. You know, and, you know, on February 16th at, 12:44 p.m., I sent him a 6-page rebuttal of his article that he entirely omitted every bit of from your show,
which I attempted to read out in my show but didn't quite get through.
Right. You know, and I don't know if you read that or the other one, but there was one that was sent from February and then one that I wrote right then that day. But you know, it starts out, you know, I've read your fallacy filled and conflated paper that intentionally focuses on a single image or a single point and omits the rest of the research provided to make your case. Is that the one that you read?
I think I actually have read both of them. The one that I read on air,
This letter was only posted on your wall and not on mine. So if you only read what was on mine, you missed this one.
No, I did both.
Okay, got it. Okay. So, yeah, and then we go into, you know, Acharya S., Robert Price's own statements. Then he makes up another lie about Robert Price's statements on that, you know. What he does is he says that ancient Christian mushroom cult idea and In this book, I very specifically argue against the ancient mushroom cult idea because of how widespread it was. So again, taking my work out of context and you know, distorting all of that. Shermer's Babylonian detection kit, which is an appeal to ridicule. You know, he doesn't just talking about, you know, Charya's ideas have been denounced. Which ones? By whom? Every single one? Really? Prove it. The onus of proof falls on you. I mean, how would they debunk primary texts like, you know, Church Father Epiphanius' text that I published in this book that I gave to Acharya? You know, I mean, how are they going to just debunk on a whim a fourth century primary Christian text? I mean, you don't just debunk something just because you say so. You know, it's not that, you know, quite that easy. So, you know, right here, and you can see this, and maybe if you put out a video version, your audience will too, but there's the text to Epiphanius right there, you know, and this is a fourth century text where he's specifically discussing all of the ties between astrotheology and Christianity.
Could you say for the audience just exactly what book and what page that's on?
Oh, boy, and I just set it down. So this is my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, and it is page. And this citation was very hard to find. I found it first in a German book, and then we had to track down the original in the Latin, which Acharya found. And then we found an English translation that was, I'll just read you what George Robert Stowe Mead said in his book, Thrice Great Hermes, from 1906.
We've only got 30 seconds. We've only got 30 seconds.
And this is from page 21 in my book, Astrotheology. And here it will be of interest to turn to a curious statement of Epiphanius. It is missing in all editions of this father prior to that of Dendorf from Leipzig, 1859, Leipzig University, which was based on the very early 10th century Codex Marcanius 125, all previous editions being printed from a severely censored and bowdlerized 14th century manuscript. And so, you know, I published this whole document in that book. I mean, all of this stuff is omitted. You know, you can't debunk somebody by ignoring their work. You go point by point. You know, they say, oh, this one thing is an error, so therefore all of their work is wrong. And this is just, you know, not critical thinking. It's delusion.
That happens to me all the time. I'll try and explain something about vaccines, and I'll be, like, slightly incorrect or something, and therefore vaccines are safe because I was incorrect right about one thing that was dangerous right that incidentally wasn't that dangerous. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
I got some so-called friends. Smile right to my face. All when my back is turned. They like to bury me without a trace. Oh no, no. Oh no, no. There's only one thing I need to know.
Welcome back. I'm flying a G. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week for your listening pleasure, 3 till 5 p.m. Pacific time for those of you on the irradiated California coastline near Bohemia Grove, where there's lots of nasty things that go on there behind the scenes with gay porn stars and whatnot, and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yeah, I can just imagine this for a moment, ladies and gentlemen. Have you ever seen or heard of, like, real debauched sex tapes being released about celebrities or something like this? Imagine for a moment. Just imagine. I'm not saying that this is true, but imagine that every single one of the really high-powered world leaders who all go to Bohemian Grove have just as many terrible things that could be released about them if they were to ever step out of line and stop spreading their BS propaganda and the agenda. Just imagine that for a moment. Then you start to realize how our society is run, I think, with a little bit of imagination, which Einstein, he said, is more important than knowledge, didn't he?
Yeah, well, let's not get into how he stole half of his stuff from the U.S. Patent Office, et cetera, and John Bjorkness' work.
Well, I guess he imagined stealing knowledge is also beneficial to oneself.
Sure. So anyway, let's dive into this because there's a few more key points that I want to touch on here before I forget. Let's see. He attacks my book, The Holy Mushroom. He omits that Ruck's endorsement is on the back cover of the book. And that says John Allegra's revelation of the sacramental role in the sacred mushroom in the ancient religion spanned the agrarian region from Mesopotamia to the Near East, was immediately and unfairly rejected by a chorus of scholars less competent than him. But continuing research into early Christianity and the mystery religions of the Greco-Roman world and their perpetuation in alchemy and European folkloric traditions has vindicated the correctness of his discovery. So, I mean, this is right on the back cover of my book from Karl Rucke. Why did he omit this? Who knows? And, you know, it's just, wow. So, let's see. And then he goes on, he attacks me for illiteracy in the Dark Ages. I didn't really get that. I mean, you just type in illiteracy in the Dark Ages in Google, and you can see that reading and writing was banned for the serfs for centuries. I mean, you know, seriously, that's why it was called the Dark Ages, because there wasn't literacy and science and all of these things. So whatever, man. I guess he's never opened a history book, doesn't know about the Dark Ages. But anybody who wants to learn about that, just type in illiteracy in the Dark Ages. And also the Catholic Church had had restrictions on reading and writing throughout various times of history.
What is the literacy level of current U.S. high school graduates? And are we entering into a new dark age?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that specifically. But, you know, I've done a lot of work with John Taylor Gatto. I had him on my show three times, who exposed a lot of that stuff regarding the whole dumbing down of education, being intentional and everything. And everyone should go out right now. And there's a link to it on GnosticMedia.com. But get John Taylor Gatto's The Ultimate History Lesson. It's a 5-hour series or 5-hour interview that my partner Richard Andrew Grove did with Tragedy and Hope, and it's mind-blowing. All the citations are right there for people to check and everything. But let me get to this one also. This is an important one. He attacks me for going on about Godfrey Driver and all these guys that wrote this thing in the London Times I started to mention earlier, attacking Allegro. But this was actually published the same week as Allegro's book. Now, when I went through we were talking about earlier about the citations in the back of Allegro's book, there is 150 pages of notes, as you can see here in the video. That's all just the notes section. Okay, so it took me just going through and getting out the entheogen citations and tracking down all of the original books and everything and checking them, took me over a year. Now, they want us to believe that 14 scholars got the book the same week it was published, read the book, studied all of those citations, interrupting everything else in their world at the same time, by the way, and tracked down, verified his work, and then wrote this article in the Times and debunked him all in 1 week. Well, guess what? You know, it took me a year just to track down, like I said, the primary citations just on entheogens, and Ruck did a lot of the philology work, not for my book, but on his own and in Fungus Redivivus, which I published. And, you know, there is just no way that even a team of 14 people could go through that many. I mean, when you open up the back of the book and you see how dense these notes and everything are, I mean, if you can see that there, you can see all of the foreign languages and everything that are intermixed there, all of the deep citations and stuff that are right there. And it's thick, heavy, dense reading to go through. And it's not something you just do on a weekend and then whip out an article to publish in the newspaper. So my argument is that these guys were, you know, just like Allegro was always at contention, which he brought up in his interview with you. Well, it was not the first time Allegro was attacked. Allegro was always attacked regarding his Dead Sea Scrolls research because he didn't agree with Catholic and Zionist interpretations. And he said, you know, we need to step back and look at this stuff in another way. So he was constantly attacked in the media and on, you know, radio shows and stuff for not toting the official line. And in fact, Allegro published all of his Dead Sea Scrolls translations in 1968, and the rest of the team didn't publish any of them until 1991. So Allegro was the only source of information in all of that time, and all of these other scholars withheld all of this stuff. You know, so of course they're going to be out there attacking Allegro for being the pioneer and being the one to promote this. And not only that, but Wasson and all of his CIA buddies were attempting to keep all of the attention focused on on Eastern religion, especially Hinduism and Buddhism, and on Native American shamanism and South American shamanism. They didn't want any focus put on Judeo-Christianity because it put the focus in the wrong direction. And then if you're looking at Judeo-Christianity and John Allegro's work, then suddenly you're, you know, studying MK Ultra through all of the false attacks against his work because of Gordon Wasson. So, you know, there's just no way, and being very familiar with Allegro's work, there's just no way that a team of these guys could have pulled that off in a week and done a thorough job. You know, if it takes one guy a year, you know, 14 guys, it would at least take them several months to do it. And so, let's see, you know, at least a month. And there's just no way. They just, you know, the attack that they published, which I've read and I don't have it in front of me, but it was primarily an attack on the principle of the matter, not the research. Just like, you know, Tom Hatzis is doing on me. He's just attacking me and the idea of these things. He's not actually going point by point through the research and the things presented. So these are these kind of tricks that they use.
Kind of like just sitting there and saying, how dare he?
Right, exactly. You know, and it's like an appeal to ridicule in a way. You know, you're wrong because, and that's their whole argument, right? So, I mean, that's one of the most common arguments that people have is the appeal to ridicule. You're wrong because, ha, ha, ha.
I might start using that. I'm right because,
right. So, you know, as like I said, he goes on to talk about how Allegro was denounced in the academic world before. And, you know, this is a poisoning the well fallacy. And he doesn't bring up what he was attacked for, the whole situation over the scrolls, how the other scholars suppressed the scrolls until 1991. And they basically cut him out of the picture because he wasn't toting the official line. You know, I've studied all of Allegro's books, and I find him to be one of the most continuously upright and solid scholars who I haven't, you know, in the 20 years I've studied him, I haven't found him intentionally fudging anything. I've found, you know, transposed numbers and letters and things like that in his work. But if people sit down and actually take the time to go through his citations, they'll find that they do, in fact, check out. Now, you know, why does Tom omit all of the academics who have endorsed my work or even come on my show endorsing my work? Professor Michael Winkelman published an academic review of my book in the academic journals, very positive review. I've worked with, you know, many dozens of scholars over the year. He brings up a couple that because of their agendas and their association with Wasson, who my work, you know, puts their work in jeopardy, he then uses them to attack me. You know, and then he also attacks like John Rush and these other guys, but he doesn't admit that John Rush is a professor as well. Well, here's another academic who agrees with my work, Garrett Kaiser, Robert Forty. You know, I've gotten many, 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 many emails over the years from academics who do, in fact, support the work. So, of course, he has to admit all of them and just focus on the negative. Then he claims that I'm all mystified by all this stuff, and it's all regular while distorting and conflating everything I ever said or published. And that I wasn't at all mystified by any of this. Mystify means to befuddle, and it's clear who's the one who is, you know, befuddled here. And let's see, you know, the whole Latin liber thing going to bark is just silly, like I already told you earlier. We read that quote, and the word, it goes back to like 20 different languages, but it's irrelevant that, you know, that the paper or the book comes from bark. Of course it does. We're not going back to the origin of papermaking. The point was that, in fact, the word liberal does come from of or befitting the free. And yes, of course, that's because of the book education. And if you want to go back further than that, yes, you can see that it was tree bark. Yay. So congratulations to him on that one. Let's see. You know, originally in his article, he was citing my interview with Joe Rogan to attack me, which I thought was really funny for a scholar, considering I've published all of this work, you know, and he attacks a comedian's interview with me, that just silly stuff. I already talked about the inflammatory wording that he uses of Christian mushroom cult when I intentionally said that I wasn't for that in my book, Total Distortion. We talked about the poisons already and how ancient cultures thought, you know, that it was all about dosage. And I've had actually, now that I think of Dan Hillman, and then there was one other, or David Hillman, there was one other book that we did on this. Oh boy, you know, there's just so much stuff in here. I got a kick out of his comments that he could, you know, relate it to another plant and everything. But obviously, this is all based on a straw man argument. and misrepresenting all of our work, as he's repeatedly proved himself doing here today. And, you know, I talk about the Caduceus in my original email to him back in February, the Caduceus, you know, and I sent him all the stuff. We covered, you know, a half a dozen or a dozen pages in my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, on the origin of the Caduceus. Caduceus is the symbol for modern medicine. Today, one cannot practice medicine without the authority of this symbol. Chiropractors and EMTs, emergency medical technicians, for example, are often represented by the staff of Asclepius, the symbol of one serpent on the staff, while modern medical doctors' symbol has two serpents. Those represented with one serpent on the staff cannot administer drugs to people, while those with two serpents may. Historically speaking, however, the staff of Asclepius was the original symbol for healing, medicine, and drugs. And I mean, you know, going back to page 115 and that image from the Boldland on, this one that we've been talking about the whole time, the roasting the salamander one. I mean, we're talking about poisons and drugs here, period. Whether it's one serpent or salamander or snake or lizard, it has to do with the same, you know, typology, the same concepts, the same ideas. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering, is there any particular reference between the snake around the staff being for medical practice and, say, the tree of knowledge or Christianity or the Adam and Eve story, anything like that?
Well, I mean, that's what we certainly argue in ANS. We have a whole section on just that in our book, Astrotheology and Shamanism. We talk about the entire origins of the symbol, and I'm showing you some of the stuff here up on the page. Even the dollar symbol has been suggested to come from it, and it goes back to, you know, the symbol of Mercury and pirates. Let me see, you know, buy now, pay later. Money can be the root of all evil. Blah blah blah. During the course of a year, the average American. Blah. And then let me skip forward. Anyway, though, there's a chapter. There's a whole section in here on these symbols, and it's like page probably 135, 140 forward. There's a whole section in that book on it. I won't go into too much detail on it here. I don't remember half of it because it's a book I wrote almost a decade ago, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's understandable. People come up to me and they say, "Hey, Vinny, you see this one thing on this one show," and I forget what this is. Dude, I've done I do a couple of hundred shows a year. I can't remember all, and there's like hours of talking within each of them. If I was to remember that much, I would be a superhuman computer, which is incidentally why I have a computer, to have all these things on archives.
Let's see here. Oh, you know, we go on about the Caduceus here. I'll read this. This is a good one. It's important to know that the symbol of the Caduceus, the symbol of drugs, is the same today as it was thousands of years ago. We find the same symbol representing drugs in the pharmacopoeia in nearly every society on Earth, whether it was Native Americans, the South Americans, Africans, Egyptians, the Middle East, in Asia, or in Europe. The symbol of drugs was ubiquitous, often when the Caduceus itself was not represented. Two cornucopias would take its place. These horns of plenty represent the entire bounty of plants. On one side, there are the plants that are harvested and consumed as food. And on the other side are the plants that are used as medicine and for spiritual purposes. Around the outer side, it says, Virtutis fortuna comes. Fortune is the companion of bravery. For further reading on the cornucopia pharmacy, or a.k.a. the pharmacopoeia, we highly recommend Dale Pindell's book. You know, so, and then snake poison was not necessarily considered poisonous. There are reports of snake venom producing pleasant visionary experiences as well, snake venom, et cetera. You know, so this is, you know, there's a whole overlap between poisons and these things that, you know, that this guy Tom completely overlooked and misrepresented, which, of course, I've covered in great detail on my show as well.
Many things can be poisonous and also be non-lethal and in some cases beneficial, but, the one thing that I've seen that can give you some kind of benefit that can't kill you is weed and vitamin C. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinny Eastwood Show Talk.
Welcome back.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the final segment here with Jan Irvin today. Now, Jan, you had one more point to cover before we can just say, all right, we've tied this little puppy with a neat little bow in a nice little package, and we'll just and we'll put it on the shelf, and then people will now have both sides of the story, the fallacious side of the story and the reality side of the story, and it'll all be clear.
Well, I think so. You know, one other point that he made about the whole argument, and for some reason, you know, again, he claimed to have read my book, but I don't understand how he could miss all of these citations that were in the book, like from Robert Graves. And I was just looking for the page here. But and Robert Graves says that when he was in Israel or in Palestine in the 1950s that he saw Amanita muscaria growing there, and this was all cited in the book. So, you know, I don't know why he, you know, it's the material on Robert Graves starts on page 60, and it's all his primary citations right there. You know, I was just seeing if I could find this this specific reference here and read it to the audience here, but you know, it's all in there. Right there, you know, also, from page 60 forward. So, but Robert Graves is talking about how he himself found the Amanita growing in Palestine in the 1950s. But not only that, but we're talking about a religion from 2,000 years ago. And 2,000 years ago, there was something in the region, and these things were very often traded, which we discussed in ANS. But that thing in the region at the time was this thing called the Cedars of Lebanon. It was a massive forest that stretched through Lebanon at the time, and it would have made a fantastic host for these types of mushrooms. So, you know, we can't look at a desert that sits there today and say, see, it's not there, it's a desert. You know, when 2,000 years ago, during the time that we're discussing, it was, in fact, a lush green forest. So why he omitted those two things that were in the book under, you know, the Robert Graves citations, I don't know, but it just fits with more of the, you know, distortions and lies that he committed against my work.
Mm. Now, I'd like to also take some callers as well. So we've thrown the lines open, ladies and gentlemen. So if you want to call in and comment on this, this is your one and only chance. You will probably only be able to take one or two callers. The number is 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525. 25. What Jan Irvin's work has meant for you, the trivium, and also the attacks upon him, and of course the defense against these attacks that we've aired today, how you feel about all of this. So 218-339-8525. And in the event that nobody calls in, me and Jan are just going to yank about stuff. It's not going to be that difficult, I don't think. Now, I also wanted to say that I want to admit some of my faults here, because I have I've prioritized getting quantity over quality with this show to a certain extent. Doing five shows a week, sometimes between 5 and 10 guests, means that the ability that I have to reference and check these guests out before they come on, and precisely what they're going to be talking about, whether or not it's 100% true, wasn't really part of my repertoire. And now, since this incident, I'm going to actually start making it that. Because I realized
they're going to hold you to it, dude.
Yeah. Well, I just realized something, that now I'm responsible for things that other people say on my show, unless I call out a disclaimer before the show starts that the views and opinions expressed by the guests.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, you can't. You know, there's no way that anybody can be 100%. You know, correct all the time. I mean, but what we have to do is process the fallacies out, check things, and we can get, you know, very close and just allow any new information in should it come in the future. And then we have a systematic way to go back and check it against the research that we've already done by, you know, simply just going who, what, where, when, why, and how.
And what I found interesting is that the process is rather simple, and maybe it, you know, when you're trying to memorize something, you need to have it repetition, just so that it sticks in your mind.
Right.
And I don't think I had enough of that. Like, I hadn't quite memorized the who, what, when, where, why, and how to the point where you can instantly recall right as the conversations are happening and point out all the fallacies as they're coming at you, kind of thing. Like it actually takes a little bit of training. This methodology, the Trivium, actually has a training process behind it, doesn't it, Ian?
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
I've not been through the process.
Well, yeah, you know, we, myself and Richard Grove and a group of us over Tragedy and Hope, we founded, you know, we did a study group for about a year and a half or 2 years where we went through the grammar and the logic and everything. And, you know, just about once a week we did this study group. And then that was a way to kind of force us to, you know, go through and study all of the references and everything. But, you know, I mean, it's a lot of work. It's, you know, it's very rewarding at the end of it all. But, you know, it's a lot of work from the get-go. And, you know, it's just basically reconditioning your mind to, you know, not think with fallacies or with lies. I mean, you know, the ones that we tell ourselves are the worst ones. And it's, you know, you can spend sometimes 5, 10 minutes or even a day maybe researching something and find out the truth of it versus spending a lifetime believing in a lie. And so, you know, what's better, to hold on to this lie for your entire life? What is more time consuming, right? And people will argue all the time that I don't have time to do this, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm not a researcher, et cetera. But, you know, if somebody makes a claim, and, you know, like in my book, there's all of these citations. So if somebody just wanted to check my citations in my Holy Mushroom book, they would go to my book, check the citations, and I've got actually everybody else's claims and primary citations listed in this book right there for people to go through. So then they would just go to these other books, open them up, you know, go on Amazon or whatever, order the books, open them up, and just check and make sure that I didn't quote anything out of context, et cetera. So that's really the, you know, the whole premise of it. And, you know, pretty much as easy as that.
Yeah, well, it's a simple process, isn't it? And I failed in my duty as you know, I never claim to have credibility because that way I can't lose it, kind of thing. That's sort of my philosophy as well. And you just got to be honest, you know. So if you're wrong and somebody comes up with evidence that you're wrong, you have to admit it as quickly as possible and make amends as quickly as possible.
Right.
And this is the very reason why you're on here today. Yeah, yeah, because I don't like that. I mean, in most cases, whenever I've gotten into arguments with people over something that I've done, I'm actually usually in the wrong, because otherwise the argument wouldn't start. And all the other times, it's just because somebody misinterpreted what I said, and then I just got to explain, this is what I meant, so on and so forth.
You'll find there's basically, you know, two essential groups of people when it comes down to work that you're putting out. Those who have studied it, and then they'll sit down with you and go point by point, you know, and they'll say, you know, I have this other citation right here that shows that this is an error, you know, and then, but, you know, these points are all correct, so we need to fix this one right here or whatever. Whereas somebody who doesn't study your work, they will give you advice about your work without reading it, telling you what you should have said without reading it, calling you names without reading it, going on and on with all manner of just fallacious nonsense. But they can never stick to any point that you ever actually wrote. So, you know, don't, you know, ignorance comes from choosing to ignore things. And if you choose to ignore things, you know, like I said, you know, instead of, studying it, removing the fallacies and contradictions from your own thoughts, verifying everything, then you come to certainty. You know, and if I'm certain about something, if I know what something says on page 21, I know what it says. You know, and it doesn't matter if somebody comes up and tells me, why do you have to be so certain? It could say something else. You know, it's like, well, I know what it says. Did you read it? I am certain what it says because I have read it. In fact, I wrote that page and I know what I was saying. And, you know, people will sit there and argue with you over what something says or means that they've never read. They won't read your argument. And it's, you know, it's just such a dishonest thing. It's like, if you want to have an intelligent conversation about something, study it, go point by point through it, check everything out, keep the work together as a whole, don't use a bunch of fallacies and, you know, lies to attack the person, and then we can sit down if you do find anything and we can discuss it. Or even if you didn't find anything, then now we can still discuss it intelligently and say, yeah, you know, we can discuss all of the points of the research, and then we can learn and grow from it rather than ignoring it. You know, essentially, And on the on my triviumeducation.com website, if people go there, there's a really good article, and I'm just pulling it up right now. It's called "Incompetent and Unaware," and it's really important for people to, and it's by David Dunning and Justin Kruger. "Unskilled and Unaware of It: How Difficulties in Recognizing One's Own Incompetence Lead to Self-Inflated Assessments." So, you know, what we have here is Tom is a perfect example of this. He doesn't go through things carefully. He takes things out of context. He jumps to page 115, ignoring all the research prior to that. You know, doesn't think through poison, drugs, blah, blah, blah. You know, but if we approach every new subject that we're getting into as if we're incompetent and then work from there, building out the grammar of all of the things that we're dealing with, then we gain and build competence, right? So you start off incompetent, and then you ask who, what, where, when, why, and how. It's okay to be incompetent because that is the starting point. If, you know, you sit there and go, I'm never incompetent, I know anything, well, guess what? Then you're always going to be incompetent, and you're always going, you know, or there is no truth, truth is arbitrary, one plus one isn't two, all this kind of nonsense, you know?
Yeah.
Just approach things with a, you know, an open heart, not necessarily an open mind, but a critical mind, and remove the contradictions and fallacies from your own thoughts.
All right. Jan Irvin, sage wisdom, as all. Thank you very much for your time indeed, and I apologize for any distress or time this has soaked up from you.
And I appreciate that as well very much, Vinny, and thanks for manning up about it. You're a real man. I've seen some of this stuff go down before, and they weren't half or a third the man as you, so...
Well, man, I'm going to take that as a quote and cite and put it as a citation on my website.
There. Oh, great. Yeah, taken out of context.
Yeah, totally, totally. Gnosticmedia.com is the website, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you again sometime at the VinnyEastwoodShow.com.